This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. African-American cooks have served in every presidential kitchen all the way back to George Washington. And the food they prepare plays into the president's image, and their roles go beyond that, as family confidants and civil rights advocates as well. A new book tells their stories. It features 150 African-American cooks and illustrates how the people behind the food sometimes played surprising roles in history. Adrian Miller is a culinary historian who authored the book The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Story of African-Americans Who Have Fed Our First Families, from the Washingtons to the Obamas. He's in the Triangle for a sold-out event at Farrington Village tonight, but first joins me in conversation. Adrian Miller, welcome back.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Last time you were here, we were talking about soul food, your last book.
That's right.
So what got you going on this subject?
Well, unemployment. So I rolled out of the Clinton administration, and the job market was really slow. So I got John Edgerton's book on the history of Southern food, which started me on the journey towards writing soul food. Mm-hmm. And it was while researching that book that I discovered all of these African-Americans who cooked for our presidents. And so I had enough stories that I thought, well, there might be something more here. And then that led to this work.
They all the way back to George Washington. Mm-hmm. So tell us about George Washington's kitchen.
Yeah. So George Washington had a multiracial kitchen. So he had enslaved cooks from Mount Vernon that he brought up. One that I talk about extensively is Hercules, his enslaved chef, who actually runs away on his 65th birthday. That was his birthday gift to Washington. His son was part-time there. And he also had a free man named Samuel Francis, who was the steward, who was kind of in charge of everything. And he was a biracial man from the West Indies.
How do you do the research on this, especially back in those days?
The boon for my research was historical newspapers. Mm-hmm. We've got the Library of Congress and several private companies that are digitizing old newspapers, and they're word searchable. So once you figure out how the kitchen was discussed and how the workers were described, and if you get a few names, then you start getting a lot of these.
How much of that, and why was that a popular topic in the popular press?
Well, I think it's because newspapers had the role of capturing daily life, and so they would just dig deeper than other mediums. And it was just a rich source of conversation. They could pass on, you know, anecdotes, give you a sense for the presidential character, because food often serves as a lens for how we view our presidents.
So what they eat and how they eat it. Yeah, exactly. That tells us who we are.
Right.
So let's do the Kitchen Confidential, going back to Washington.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson, great story there that you tell about one of his cooks.
Right. So one of Sally Hemings' older brothers was a guy named James Hemings. And when Jefferson is minister to France, he actually brings a young James Hemings, he was about 19 years old, over to France. And he spends 3 years having him trained as a classical French chef. And he becomes the chef de cuisine for Jefferson's resident in Paris. And then he makes a lot of Jefferson's favorite food, including mac and cheese. Jefferson loved mac and cheese.
And, of course, they really knew how to make it in Paris, which
yes.
is where he learned that whole trick.
Right.
And called it macaroni, I think. But also, Jefferson had a cook who was maybe a sous chef who had a boyfriend who he didn't want to see hanging around.
Right.
Husband.
So he had two enslaved women in the White House kitchen. A woman, their nicknames were Fanny Hearn and Edie Fawcett. And they spent their entire lives pretty much in that kitchen, because even though Jefferson would leave to go back to Monticello during the summer months, and if you spend any time in D.C., you know what that's like.
Yeah. That's why I'm here.
Yeah. So he would leave them behind to be a skeletal, you know, to cook for the skeleton crew. So their husbands missed their wives, and so some of them would leave Monticello, and Jefferson would intercept them before they even got to the White House and send them back.
Yeah. How much recognition? I mean, I think what's interesting, among the many interesting things about your book, is the ways in which those cooks and chefs were and were not recognized in their time. Tell us a little bit about that, and maybe you can give us some stories that illustrate it.
Right. So well into the 20th century, cooking was one of the few professions that African-Americans could pursue and excel in. And it's part and parcel of the whole idea that African-Americans were born servants and natural cooks. So given the racial dynamic of the times and a lot of these newspaper accounts, they would just say Negro cook or colored cook because there was no reason to mention the person's name. But then after emancipation, we start to see some bright signs where some of these cooks are not only their full names given, but there are newspaper headlines of their hire. And I'm thinking mainly of Laura Dolly Johnson, who was the cook for Benjamin Harrison, who displaces the French cook. And she was not happy about that, the French cook. She had a very American response to this situation. She filed a lawsuit against the president, the first known lawsuit from a White House staffer against the president for wrongful discharge. And then she went to the press and talked about the poor eating habits of the Harrisons, that they ate pie all the time.
Wow. Yeah. With this idea that you could glorify African-Americans in the press is something you talk about because, and I guess it's something you suggested earlier, this was an area in which, because of stereotype, it was safe to glorify the virtues of people who are African American.
Right. And it goes to the next level because there was an ongoing rivalry between French cooking and American cooking. And often the face of American cooking were African American cooks, particularly African American women. And so you see this play out through the White House. In fact, you see a lot of, you know, American chauvinists basically saying, yeah, we need a black cook in the White House.
This is fascinating. Yeah, and again, one of the fascinating aspects of this, because in order to be a host, as the president must be, and have all these dinners, you had to show the world that you were sophisticated enough to have a French chef.
Yeah.
To get reelected, you had to be American enough to have an American chef, which at the time, and may, perhaps still does, mean an African-American cook.
Absolutely. And in fact, some had tried to have it both ways, where they would have their enslaved cooks actually train under French chefs so that they can master the French cooking as well as the homey American cooking. So, yeah, they're definitely trying to maintain that balance.
Hence the Parisian mac and cheese. So the fun stuff, though, is LBJ's cooks and kitchen. And we've got some – partly because we have some of the tape. But tell us more about that. And also I think it illustrates the bind that a president is in and having to demonstrate their American tastes.
Oh, yeah. I call it the presidential pickle because we want our presidents to be extraordinary people. But we also want them to be a lot like us. And so they show that by, you know, the common touch by liking the foods of their childhood and regional favorites. So the tape you're going to play here is a clip from the White House recording system, which was actually started under Kennedy. LBJ greatly expands it, and then he recommends it to Nixon, and we know how that turned out.
All right. Well, let's listen to this. This is because now there's a question, and we're hearing from his secretary. The secretary is calling the cook, right?
So
that's what we're going to hear in this clip.
Right.
We have correspondents asking us if the president and the family like beans. Well, I know enough to say yes, but I wanted to check with you.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say if you were asked that question by a responsible person?
Oh, I would say yes.
And
didn't ask what kind, did he?
No, but I know that he particularly likes pork and beans.
He likes pork and beans, he likes pinto beans, he likes lima beans, green beans.
That's green limas, or dried.
Green limas.
Green.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Yeah.
That was such a charming conversation. I could have listened to that forever.
So you've got Juanita Roberts, who is LBJ's social secretary, talking to Zephyr Wright, his longtime family cook. And what precipitated this was the White House released a recipe for Texas chili. And if you know anything about Texas chili, it's beanless. Americans freaked out and wanted to know if the president loved beans. So this is the spin control effort.
And we had another clip. I don't think we have it here now, but where she actually specifically asks, now, have you seen any of those chili recipes? And the cook says, no. And they very politely kind of dance all around that. Fascinating stuff. But again, I think some of the more interesting aspects of what that kitchen meant even to the presidency. Tell us a story about Lizzie McDuffie, who actually became a civil rights advocate.
Yeah. So Lizzie McDuffie was mainly a maid, but she would help out with food service, especially when FDR, she was during the Franklin Roosevelt era, when he would travel. And she during the 1936 election, she actually goes on the stump in several cities that have a large black voting bloc. And stumps for the president. Now, the Hatch Act was in place, so I don't know how she got
That's
around that.
Meaning you can't have a job and lobby for the person you're working for. Right.
Yeah. So after the election, which worked out for Roosevelt, he calls her to the Oval Office and thanks her.
How did that work? I mean, in terms of asking her to do that, what was the relationship between FDR and well, Lizzie in particular, in order to, I mean, is this something she volunteered to do or was there some,
yeah,
did they talk about it?
What you find time and time, you see a lot of affection going both ways between the cooks and these presidents. So her husband was a longtime valet for Roosevelt, and that's how she kind of gets into his orbit. And she had so much affection for him that she volunteered to do this. It wasn't even FDR's idea.
Was there other, and what about other relationships? We know that there are presidents who are certainly less affectionate toward African-American communities in their policies. What about the relationship with the staffs? Do we see kind of politics playing a part in those relationships?
Right. Often we see presidents using the cooks as a sounding board. And these cooks are caught in the middle because the president would check in with them to say, you know, do African-Americans appreciate what I'm doing for them, that kind of thing. But then civil rights advocates who could not get direct access to the president would go to the cooks and just ask them to whisper in his ear and talk about certain things.
And did that work? And how did that happen?
It worked to some extent. Most of the times the cooks felt that they were in a defensive position because obviously the presidents were never doing enough. But the best example is LBJ with Zephyr Wright again. He used her Jim Crow experiences to lobby for the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And when he signed that landmark legislation, he gives her one of the pins and says, you deserve this as much as anyone.
Experiences that they actually encountered firsthand when they drove back and forth between Texas and D.C., right?
Absolutely, yes. She suffered so many indignities. She couldn't go to the bathroom. She couldn't eat with the family. She just stopped going on the trip. She would stay in Washington, D.C. year-round. And then That really gave LBJ grist for the mill as he lobbied for that bill.
It's interesting to think about that, and you don't know if it's her relationship and her role as a cook, but LBJ is someone who, at least in popular imagination, is someone who has evolved in his consciousness from his earliest days in politics to the end. And you wonder to what extent being able to have a personal relationship like that was what gave him the compassion or the feeling of what was happening to communities that weren't his.
I definitely think that's part of it. What I like to tell people is that these cooks gave our presidents a window on black life that they might not otherwise have had. Now, a lot of presidents chose not to open that window, but the few who did, I think our nation is better for it.
Yeah, and tell us more about that. I mean, FDR, Lyndon Johnson, others who actively sought the advice of the staff.
Yeah, now it's hard to tell because there's a code of silence around White House staffers, but we know that Eisenhower, with his valet, John Mooney, who was his valet from World War II, he brings him to the White House. And we find that Mooney, in his oral histories and memoirs, he talks about the relationship he had with Eisenhower and how he felt that Eisenhower was trying to do more in civil rights and how he was caught in the middle and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Any ideas? Did you discover that there were dishes that were created as a result of the needs, the press of business at the White House?
I didn't find out about that. The interesting thing is the souffle. So there's the story that Daisy Bonner, a cook for FDR, when he would go to Warm Springs, Georgia, she had a souffle time for the day that he died. It was time to be eaten at 1:15. He has his hemorrhage at 1:12. And then I'm about to tell you about a miracle. She says that the souffle did not fall until 2 hours later when FDR was pronounced dead.
Wow.
And then just another souffle story. JFK was notoriously late, so the chef figured out that if he was going to have a souffle, he would make four separate souffles and cook them at 15-minute intervals, just hoping that JFK would arrive to eat one before fall.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Well, there's some great stuff. Again, I have to play this clip because it's kind of out of nowhere. But again, this goes back to LBJ and a part of these conversations that were recorded on the very system that undid Richard Nixon. But here they serve a higher purpose, and that is culinary history. So in this case, our cook has asked about an all-American cheese treat. Let's listen.
You used to use the Velveeta, but you don't do that anymore.
Well, I do that for parties. We use the Velveeta, also mushrooms. You know, you call it lima beans with cheese and mushroom sauce.
Uh-huh.
That's about the perfect name for that, isn't
it? Yeah, special occasion food.
In the White House under LBJ. So what were some of the big surprises for you?
One is just the constancy. And after you dig into it, you're like, okay, given the racial dynamic and how people felt about black people, it's not a surprise. But just to see African-Americans, every aspect of the cooking, I mean, in the White House basement kitchen, in the White House mess, in the West Wing, on the presidential boat, train, and plane, and just see this comprehensive nature of how they made our presidents happy and healthy was just astounding to me. And then the civil rights advocacy part that we talked about, I just never thought about that because I thought it would be sight unseen for a lot of these cooks, but they definitely had a role.
Well, and Eleanor Roosevelt, we know, had an important role because of her deep connections within African-American communities, and particularly the African-American women who were working so hard back then. She had the president's ear. Did she play any role in the kitchen and spend much time down there?
Unfortunately, she was fundamentally uninterested in food and delegated to someone who wasn't that good at it. So the food during the FDR administration had a horrible reputation. If you were invited to the FDR White House for a state dinner, you would actually think about eating before you went.
Oh, my goodness.
It was that bad.
Oh, that's a terrible... So those stories, and you've got recipes in here.
Yes. So I have about 20 recipes. Many of them are actual White House recipes adapted for contemporary kitchens. I have a recipe for the Nelson Mandela State Dinner, if you want to replicate that in your home. And also have a recipe from a young lady who represented Colorado at the 2014 Kids State Dinner held by Michelle Obama. It was a healthy kids eating contest. Her name is Kiana Farkas. She was the hardest interview to get for my book because I dated her mom and it did not end well.
See, what, you could have put that in the appendix or something, just a little something to spice it up. Too bad now. I think you rushed to publish this because, you know, you waited 4 more years. I'd love to know what goes on in that Trump kitchen.
Oh, so would I. Huh? Right now we have Obama holdovers in the kitchen because Trump hasn't, to our knowledge at least, has not made any wholesale changes in the White House kitchen. So they are just working day to day until he makes up his mind what he's going to do.
That is the story I want to hear next. What are you working on now?
So I'm really interested in doing a book on the history of African-American barbecue tradition. Because if you consume food media, I mean, all they show are white hipsters and bubbas. Yeah. You wouldn't even know that black people barbecue.
Yeah.
And I want to show just kind of profiles of the big names and the personalities that help shape this barbecue culture.
Well, you have come to the right place for that. Mm-hmm. And we will have you back when you're done with that book. Always.
Sounds great.
Adrian, always a pleasure. Adrian Miller is a James Beard Award-winning author. His new book, The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Story of the African Americans Who Have Fed Our First Families from Washington's to Obama's. And you can find out more about him and his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brooklyn, and Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.